This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Wednesday,
this is all about ensuring that we come through the worst pandemic we've seen in 100 years and that recovery cannot be taken for granted.
Shedding the ideological shackles of small government, the big spending budget has been unveiled. There's a lot in the detail and a debt bill heading towards $1 trillion. We'll take you through the latest. While spending the country's way out of COVID, can Josh Frydenberg's budget splash create jobs and supercharge the economy? On today's program, we're going to take you through some of the numbers and get budget analysis from experts on everything from aged care to women and mental health. But first, let's get some views from voters.
They're doing what they can for the economy and are probably doing quite well, I think, at the moment. I'm happy about the aged care spending as well.
Yes, that's been long overdue.
The government getting on and helping, you know, the aged facilities, which was in a terrible disarray. I think it's money well spent. Yes, our children's children will be taking on the deficit, but we have no other alternative.
I was interested in the women's package, in inverted commas. It seemed to me that it was more just additional funding for existing things.
Our iron ore trade with China sort of underpins the federal budget. You know, all of the sort of social welfare changes that were being sort of proposed rightfully, I think, last night. The relationship with China is so critical. I think we need to be doing more to sort of smooth that out, to sort of underpin that trading relationship and continue sort of being able to fund all of the social welfare changes we put through.
Childcare in Australia is exceptionally expensive, and it shouldn't be. It just seems that as soon as they give a subsidy, the childcare centres seem to increase it by that subsidy.
That's some of the budget views from the streets this morning. Well, we head to Canberra now, and joining us is our political reporter, Noor Haider, at Parliament House. Noor, this budget is a big change from the Coalition's traditional ethos. How has the Prime Minister been selling the budget this morning?
Yeah, good morning, Sally. It certainly is a massive departure from the Coalition's budgets in years gone by. Before the pandemic, there was an obsession with returning the budget back to black. But yesterday's budget predicts deficits will last at least a decade and debt will peak close to $1 trillion in 4 years. It spends big on things like aged care, an extra $18 billion injected into that sector. Billions also being pumped into childcare to make that cheaper for families, and money for the nation's mental health. Those measures have been broadly welcomed. Beyond that, there's also an extension to personal income tax cuts and asset write-offs for businesses. The main message from the budget and the Prime Minister this morning in his media appearances is that spending is needed to drive down unemployment and boost investment during a time of global uncertainty.
The way you actually support a budget is by ensuring that there are taxpayers in the economy. You don't have taxpayers if you don't have people in jobs. And that's why this budget has to focus in the middle of a pandemic, when monetary policy is basically spent, when you've got global borders shut because of the raging pandemic all around the world. The suggestion that somehow you might open up to that raging pandemic now, I think would be one of the worst things you could do for our economy.
That's the Prime Minister. Noor, this budget has further fuelled speculation of a potential election this year. What's the reaction been from Labor?
Well, the federal opposition this morning has described this budget as a political fix. They argue that the government has created this document with its eye on the next election, not the Australian people. They've also questioned why the budget doesn't include money for quarantine facilities, given it assumes that international borders will remain closed until the middle of next year. The Labor leader, Anthony Albanese, says the budget lacks vision and doesn't do enough to address underemployment and wage stagnation.
We have $1 trillion of debt, but no legacy for it. It's all about short-term political expediency, and wages are going to not keep up with the cost of living over the next 4 years. That's the damning indictment of this government in its own budget papers.
That's the Federal Opposition Leader, Anthony Albanese. And before that, our political reporter, Noor Haider, in Canberra. So what do economists think of the budget bottom line? Has the government done enough to bring down unemployment and stimulate growth? I spoke a short time ago with Danielle Wood, the CEO of the Grattan Institute.
I think the government has adopted the right fiscal strategy here. So what they've said is they'll continue to support the economy until unemployment comes down with a 4 in front of it. We can expect that unemployment might hit that 4.5% mark by 2024-25. That's great news. What's not so great news is that despite pushing unemployment down that low, we're actually not going to see any real wages growth until 2024-25. And that's why I think it really is important for them to keep pushing with this strategy, because until we actually get to that point where wages are growing, we're not going to see that private sector recovery take off in full. We need that confidence from wages growth, consumer spending to spark more business investment, and that's really what the government's pushing towards.
So for the average household, is the next 12 months going to seem different in the hip pocket, or is it going to seem roughly the same?
Certainly, as the unemployment rate falls, that's a great thing for the economy. It's particularly a great thing for people out of work because it means more opportunities to become employed. I expect we will see more consumer spending. A lot of households build up some saving buffers during the crisis. And of course, if you use any of the services that received more funding in the budget, then you might stand to gain. So there was quite a big spend on aged care. It won't be the transformative change that the Royal Commission recommended. And the less significant, some benefits for childcare and mental health services. So a lot of households may well benefit from those spends.
We had a bit of a softening up from the Treasurer in the week leading up to the budget about this big change in economic thinking to stimulate the economy and being more focused on that rather than bringing the budget into balance. How different does this budget look to 2 years ago, for example?
It certainly looks incredibly different. So 2 years ago, we were, on the cusp of a surplus, the back in black budget. We didn't quite get back in black, but close to. And then over the medium term, which is sort of 10 years out, we had surpluses as far as the eye could see. We had net debt projected to come down to zero at the end of that 10-year period. This time around, payments will be staying higher as a share of the economy. Receipts stay lower, certainly, than they were pre-COVID. And that means that the government is projecting that it will continue to run deficit for the next decade. The good news is, with interest borrowing so low, that is quite a sustainable strategy. So net debt then starts to come down as a share of the economy over the 10 years. So debt will be coming down as a share of GDP, even with the government still running deficits out over the decade.
That's Danielle Wood, CEO of the Grattan Institute. Well, as we've heard, the federal government has announced $17.7 billion in funding for aged care. The Health Minister, Greg Hunt, says it's a once-in-a-generation overhaul. But is it good or bad news for the aged care sector? Dr. Sarah Russell is the co-founder of Aged Care Reform Now. I spoke to her a short time ago.
Somewhere in between, Sally. I think any extra money into aged care is going to be welcomed. However, we still don't have transparency, and financial transparency is so important in this sector because we need to know how the providers are spending this money. So I'm very disappointed that more emphasis wasn't placed on transparency.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that we need to know that the money that particularly this extra money that's going into aged care is actually spent on the person getting the support, not on the providers getting executive salaries and driving sports cars.
So for individual residents, are you expecting any big change?
Residents who wake up in the aged care home today are not going to notice any change, because some of these recommendations and funding increases don't happen for at least 12 months. So today's residents are not going to notice any change, and in the future they may notice a little bit of extra time spent by a carer or a registered nurse in the aged care home. But these changes have not been substantial.
What about for those people who are awaiting home care packages? We know that that waiting list has been very long. This investment that the government has announced, what effect are you expecting on those waiting lists?
More home care packages is welcomed. People want to stay at home, and this is welcomed. They say this is going to get rid of the waiting list by the end of next year. Well, fingers crossed that happens, but I don't see that happening with this sort of investment, particularly the fact that only 12,000 of these packages are level 4, which is the highest level of package. That's not enough.
What about compliance overall? You're talking about transparency and compliance. What kind of compliance measures are you hoping there, not only for the spending, but making sure that time spent is actually being spent with residents?
Well, I actually haven't heard how they're going to measure this time. To me, it seems it's either going to increase documentation. I'm not very optimistic Given the history of what we've heard over the last 2 years in this Royal Commission of neglect and negligence and abuse, I don't see this extra time and the compliance to providing extra time for each resident is going to make a big difference. I think we are going to continue to hear stories of negligence and neglect and abuse.
Is it about the quality of care as much as the quantity?
The biggest thing that should have been addressed in this budget is the workforce. We are going to need more people wanting to work in aged care homes. We're going to need more people wanting to work in people's homes as well. So we need a workforce that is, we're encouraging people to come into the workforce. We're paying them a decent salary to work in the aged care workforce and we retain them. But by and large, this budget did not address sufficiently the workforce crisis in aged care.
That's Dr. Sarah Russell, co-founder of Aged Care Reform Now. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Well, this federal budget is attempting to address what's been dubbed as the government's women problem. Billions of dollars have been allocated to tackle violence against women, as well as a targeted boost to women's health. The budget also aims to increase women's participation in the workforce, and that includes making childcare cheaper. But is it enough? Catherine Gregory reports.
Scott Morrison's attempt to woo women voters has caught the eye of Sydney mother Kate Burns.
Any help that's going to ease the amount that we're spending on childcare is going to be advantageous.
Her 12-month-old son is just starting daycare so she can return to work, and all of her wage will go into covering the childcare cost. But now she's one of the lucky Australians who will benefit from some of the changes to the government's $1.7 billion childcare package. That's because the $10,000 subsidy cap will be removed, meaning she'll get more of the childcare fees subsidised. But she will miss out on the other main benefit, where the costs of a second child in childcare is more heavily subsidised, sometimes up to 95%.
I'm not a stay-at-home mum. For me, I want to get back into the workforce. I want to contribute to society. I want to be financially secure. I want to build a future for myself and my family.
Some advocates think it's a move in the right direction, but there's room to do a lot more to get women participating in the economy. Sam Mostyn is the president of Chief Executive Women.
The thing that was missing for us last night was a real focus on paid parental leave, the payment of superannuation on existing paid parental leave supports, and things that we know really do prevent women from returning to work.
Sam Mostyn is also pleased the budget has included a provision to allow employees who earn less than $450 a month to still get the superannuation guarantee, as that often applies to women.
Australia ranks at 70th in the world on the World Economic Forum's the highest educated group of women in the world, and women want to work. I think when we think about women's economic participation, we also should think about men and men's response to this, that if we can have policies that encourage men to take up paid parental leave, take more time out themselves for caring, and ensure that we get much more balance into our system.
The budget also includes an additional $1.1 billion to stem the scourge of domestic violence. That includes more money for legal centres, emergency accommodation and frontline services. Angela Lynch is the CEO of Women's Legal Service Queensland.
Look, I am really heartened by this package. The government has acknowledged the crucial role of women's legal services and their role in responding to violence against women.
The package also includes a new trial program to give women fleeing violent relationships up to $5,000 in assistance for things like rent, legal fees and furniture. Annabelle Daniel, the CEO of Women's Community Shelters and the chair of Domestic Violence New South Wales, says it will make a difference.
We know that one of the predominant reasons that women don't leave is because they don't have the money to do so. Women's economic safety is fundamentally tied up with their physical safety.
There's also money for women's health. That includes improving cervical and breast cancer screening, as well as depression services for pregnant women and new mothers, and programs that tackle eating disorders and pain management for endometriosis.
That's Catherine Gregory reporting. Well, the federal government has also allocated $2.3 billion to suicide prevention and mental health in the budget. The funding will be used for a range of projects, including a National Office for Suicide Prevention and follow-up care for people who have attempted suicide. Nevis Murray is CEO of Suicide Prevention Australia.
Look, there's probably good news and bad news. The very good news is that there is a significant focus on suicide prevention for the first time in any budget, to my knowledge. And that's a very important step forward for our community when you consider that 65,000 people a year make an attempt on their life. This commitment is an exceptionally good start to the reform that we need to achieve the change that will support people to avoid distress that leads them to a suicide attempt.
So, Nevis, what's the money there and what will that actually do in a practical sense?
One of the big steps forward in last night's budget was the announcement of $12.8 million to establish a national suicide prevention office focused on the prevention of suicide. This is important because by having an office, we can achieve the appropriate infrastructure to ensure that services are going in places where they need to be.
Why do you think it took the government so long to listen, to put these kind of measures in place?
I think it's fair to say that historically we've seen suicide prevention through the lens of mental ill health. People who do make an attempt on their life or who die by suicide aren't always suffering or experiencing mental ill health. It's other factors that cause them distress that lead to a suicide attempt.
What does your research and experience tell you about the Australians who are most at risk of suicide? Demographically, what are you seeing now?
Sally, there's, and in fact, this is probably one of the things that has left us disappointed in the budget. Three out of four people who die by suicide are men, and men weren't captured as part of the priority populations in this budget. Importantly, we saw measures for Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people in our community who have a very high rate of suicide. We also saw investments in suicide prevention activities for younger people, again, very important measures. But the facts are that three out of four people who die by suicide, that's seven men every day. That die by suicide, they weren't targeted as a priority group in this budget. And we've certainly been calling and will continue to call for a national suicide prevention strategy targeting men.
Why are those numbers so high for men, Nevis?
Well, there's certainly been discussions around definitions of masculinity and what that means in its totality. And I think those discussions need to continue. Now, that's not to say that issues about women's independence and protection of women aren't important as well. But in having those discussions, we mustn't ever forget that there's actually two sides to this. And we need to not leave men behind in those discussions, I think. That I think, is crucial if we're going to achieve a secure safety net, particularly around suicide prevention for both men and women, and also people who don't identify with being either men or women. So the LGBTIQ community, for example, have a very high rate of suicide. So they're very, very important areas to consider. Gender is a very important consideration.
That's Nevis Murray, CEO of Suicide Prevention Australia. Well, with deficits beyond the horizon and eye-watering levels of debt, how have credit rating agencies reacted to the budget? And is Australia's AAA status safe? I spoke earlier with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, good afternoon. Should the federal government be worried that its AAA rating may be in jeopardy?
Well, not just yet, Sally, but global ratings agencies are happy to maintain the top-tier AAA rating for now, despite Josh Frydenberg's third budget predicting big deficits in coming years and no date when the budget will return to balance or surplus, critical given that net debt, which is raised to fund the deficit, will be close to $1 trillion by June 2025. Two of the big three agencies, Standard & Poor's and Fitch Ratings, say the future remains uncertain, which is why they're keeping Australia's rating on a negative outlook, meaning it could be cut in coming years. S&P says fiscal consolidation, in other words, the budget repair, could take longer than expected, given that the government says it won't be prioritising budget repair unless the jobless rate gets below the pre-pandemic level of 5.1%. S&P also says trade tensions, presumably with China, and geopolitical risks are also likely to hinder parts of of the economy, while Fitch sees uncertainties in light of the evolving pandemic. So all in all, no change to the AAA, but with a negative outlook, big spending and massive debt, that top rating can't be assured.
So, Peter, how do things look internationally? Because the US and Britain have even more debt than us. What would change if Australia lost its AAA rating?
Well, a credit rating downgrade would potentially raise the cost of borrowing for governments and big business and banks in overseas markets, which in turn could be passed on to consumers. Now, while a cut to the AAA is not imminent, there is a lot of sensitivity about the outlook for $1 trillion in debt eventually, especially with concerns about rising inflation putting pressure on central banks to raise interest rates sooner than expected, and that would make borrowing costs a little more painful. There was a good example of that on Wall Street this morning with a bit of a sell-off ahead of a big inflation report out in the US overnight. Not quite a temper tantrum, but evidence once again about the sensitivity of potential rate rises if that punch bowl of cheap and easy money that investors have become used to is taken away. The Australian share market was down around 0.7% in late morning trade on those inflation and potential rate rise concerns.
That's our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Finally today, one sector not happy with the budget is clean energy, claiming it misses another opportunity to move to a green economy. The who's who of the industry were all together at a conference in Sydney today. Joining them was a prominent former Prime Minister, not known for holding back on his views about the party he once led. Gavin Coote reports.
The challenge of moving away from coal to a greener energy system, it's sure to be a question on the minds of many world leaders in the lead-up to a global summit in November. For its part, Australia has what the Morrison government's calling a technology roadmap, and part of last night's budget detailed some of the spending that'll go into it. If clean energy advocates had hoped for a green budget, then it's fairly safe to say they were wrong. At a smart energy conference in Sydney today, there wasn't all that much excitement. There was, in fact, a lot of disappointment.
It is actually Australia's sliding door moment. Which path do we choose? And unfortunately, once again, the federal government has chosen a path that leads us nowhere.
John Grimes is the chief executive of the Smart Energy Council. He insists the industry isn't looking for subsidies for renewables, but does worry about where the money's being spent.
Where the government has spent money has been on hydrogen. But you see, when the federal government talks about hydrogen, they're talking about blue hydrogen and brown hydrogen. They're talking about hydrogen made from fossil fuels. This is a foil to keep the fossil fuel sector in business, and people should call it out for what it is.
What the federal government is doing is putting $643 million over the next 4 years into low emissions technologies like hydrogen and carbon capture and storage. Not everyone, though, in the Liberal Party is giving much thought to the idea of using fossil fuels like gas or coal to make hydrogen. The New South Wales Energy Minister, Matt Keane, who's at times been critical of his colleagues in Canberra, didn't mention the budget while speaking at today's summit. But he did talk about hydrogen, and that unlike the Commonwealth's plan, it would only be made from renewables in his state.
We can't do other forms of hydrogen here in New South Wales because we can't store the carbon. We don't have the geology to be able to do that. So we have to do green hydrogen, which only comes from using renewables.
Another Liberal figure who's been outspoken about the federal government's direction on energy was also at the conference. That's former Prime Minister turned critic Malcolm Turnbull.
So I was disappointed, frankly, in the budget that while I think it was a good budget overall, and I think Josh Frydenberg has done a great job and the government's done well and, you know, driving economic growth and maintaining it during this terrible pandemic. But it was a bit nostalgic for me, that budget, because the only clean energy projects that were named were Snowy 2.0 and the Tasmanian Battery of the Nation project, both of which I announced in 2017. Now, that's 4 years ago. That is an eon in the energy transition and in politics. But nothing new has been proposed or got underway.
When asked what would take the Morrison government to change course on energy policy, Malcolm Turnbull thinks it could rest with voters.
At this stage, I'd say only the prospect of electoral defeat, whether that's at the hands of the Labor Party, which would seem implausible, or independents who are supporters of, you know, climate action.
There is $30 million in the federal budget for a major battery storage facility to support rooftop solar users in the Northern Territory, along with a network of renewable energy microgrids across remote communities.
That's Gavin Cooch reporting. That's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. The PM team will be along tonight, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow with more stories from across Australia and around the world. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara. Take care and enjoy your afternoon.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we're coming to you from inside the Treasury's budget lockup for the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. So it's a pretty odd budget, and it's in much better shape than even the government was expecting just a few months ago. But instead of pocketing all the cash for budget repair, the government is spreading it around.
Today on The Signal, has the coalition had a fundamental economic conversion, or is this budget all about the upcoming election? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.